The first is plain to see. No part of the earth, whatever it may be, can possibly touch heaven, for the reason given earlier, that a center cannot touch a circumference. The second is that the Itha, sacred fire, is an unquenchable flame, as its very name shows, derived from Athene, which in ordinary speech means to burn. A single witness to this from the portion of heavenly fire is the sun, which, though it stands so far from the earth, sends its rays all the way to earth's innermost recesses, and both warms and scorches the air that stretches from earth up to the heavenly sphere, air that is by nature cold. Whatever lies far from the sun's path, or is set at an angle to it, it only warms, but whatever lies near it, or directly in its path, it sets ablaze by force. If this is so, was it not inevitable that the men who dared to climb upward would be consumed by fire, struck by a thunderbolt, before their grandiose scheme could be brought to completion? This seems to be hinted at in what is said afterward. They stopped, it says, building the city and the tower, Gen 11, 8, not, surely, because they had finished, but because they were prevented from completing it by the confusion that fell upon them. Yet those who had gone as far as forming the plan, and setting their hands to the work, did not thereby escape responsibility for what they had attempted. The diviner and reader of omens, then, who deals in vain guesses about uncertain things, for Balaam, too, is translated vain. The law says that the seer curses him, even though in his words he framed only auspicious blessings. For God looks not at what is said, which by his providence was altered like a genuine coin substituted for a counterfeit, but at the intent, in which harm rather than benefit was being rehearsed. For these things are by nature at war with one another. Conjecture with truth, vanity with knowledge, and prophecy that comes through frenzy with sober wisdom. Moreover, if a man lies in ambush intending to kill someone and fails to do so, he is nonetheless liable to the same penalty as a murderer, as the law written concerning such matters makes clear. If, it says, a man attacks his neighbor to kill him by treachery, and he flees for refuge, you shall take him even from the altar to put him to death, Exod. 21:14. Though he only made the attempt and did not actually kill, the law reckoned the intent to murder an equal wrong to the killing itself. For this reason, it granted no amnesty, even to one who had become a suppliant, but commanded that the man who had acted with an unholy purpose be dragged away even from the sanctuary. He is unholy not only because he plotted against a soul capable of living forever through the acquisition and exercise of virtues, a murder carried out through the assault of vice, but also because he lays the blame for his impious daring upon God. For the word flees for refuge implies this very meaning, that many who wish to escape the charges against themselves and think to deliver themselves from the wrongs they have done, cast the guilt properly their own, deserving punishment, upon God, who is the cause of no evil but of every good. For this reason, it was judged a holy thing to drag such men away even from the altars themselves. Scripture also sets an extraordinary penalty against those who build up and reinforce arguments in support of atheism, a penalty that some of the foolish might suppose to be not a harm, but a benefit. Nothing they set their minds to do, it says, shall fail them, Gen 11, 6. What boundless, immeasurable misery. That everything the most deranged mind sets itself to attempt should lie subject and obedient to it, with nothing at all, great or small, ever lagging behind, but as though racing to meet each need before it even arises. This is the demonstration of a soul bereft of good sense, one that finds nothing standing in the way of its wrongdoing. For a person not yet beyond all cure would rather pray that his mind's every resource fail him entirely, than that he should find easy success whenever he sets himself to steal, commit adultery, murder, or rob a temple, or attempt any such deed, and would rather find countless obstacles blocking the way. For one who is hindered casts off the greatest sickness, injustice, but one who carries the deed through unopposed takes that sickness upon himself. Why then do you still envy and admire the fortunes of tyrants as blessed, fortunes by which they carry out with ease whatever their raging, brutalized minds conceive, when you ought instead to groan within yourselves over such men? If indeed helplessness and weakness are profitable to evils, in the same way that abundance and strength are most beneficial to goods. But one of the foolish, perceiving to what extreme of misery the license to go on sinning leads, said with candor, "My guilt is too great to be forgiven," Gen 4:13. "For it is a terrible thing to leave a soul unbridled, since by its own nature it is untamed, and can only be gentled by being held in check with reins, and, if need be, the threat of the whip. For this reason, an oracle of the holy God, full of gentleness and sketching out good hopes, was set down for those who love discipline to this effect: I will never let you go, nor will I ever abandon you," Josh 1:5. For when the bonds of the soul by which it was held fast are loosened, the greatest of disasters follows in their train, to be abandoned by God, who has bound the whole universe with the unbreakable bonds of his own powers, by which, having drawn everything tight, he wills all things to remain unbroken. And indeed he says elsewhere, "Everything that is bound fast by a bond is clean, numb." 19:15, since dissolution is the cause of unclean corruption. So then, whenever you see one of the base easily accomplishing everything he sets himself to do, never marvel at him as though he were succeeding. On the contrary, pity him as one who is failing, because he lives on in a state barren of virtue and abundantly fertile in vice. It is worth pausing to consider what sense lies behind the words spoken in the person of God. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there. Gen 11:7. For he appears to be conversing with certain others as his fellow workers, and the same thing was written earlier concerning the making of man. God said, "Let us make man according to our image and likeness." Gen 1:26, where "let us make" shows a plurality. And again, God said, "Behold, Adam has become like one of us in knowing good and evil." Gen 3:22, for the phrase "like one of us" is set not with reference to one, but to several. We must say this first. Nothing among existing things has come into being equal in honor to God. There is one ruler and leader and king, to whom alone it belongs to govern and administer the whole. The rule of many is not good. Let there be one ruler, one king, and this could rightly be said with even more justice of the cosmos and of God than of cities and of men. For it is necessary that of one thing there be one maker, and again, one father and master. This point having been established beforehand, it would follow to weave in what fits with it. Let us consider, then, what this is. God, though he is one, has around him countless powers, all of them assisting and preserving what has come into being, among which are also the powers that punish. And even punishment is not, properly speaking, harmful, since it is a restraint and correction of wrongdoing. Through these powers, the incorporeal and intelligible cosmos was framed. The archetype of this visible one, composed of invisible forms, just as this visible cosmos is composed of visible bodies. Struck with awe, then, at the nature of each of these two worlds, some people not only deified them as wholes, but also deified the most beautiful parts within them, the sun, the moon, and the whole of heaven, which, feeling no shame at all, they called gods. Moses, discerning their folly, says, "Lord, Lord, King of gods, Deut 10:17, to mark the difference between the one who rules and those who are subject to him. There is also, throughout the air, a most sacred choir of incorporeal souls, attendants upon the heavenly bodies. The oracular word is accustomed to call these souls angels. So the whole host of each rank, arrayed in its fitting order, serves and ministers to the commander who arrayed it, and follows him, in his lawful and rightful command, as its leader. For it is not permitted that the divine army should ever be found guilty of desertion. It befits a king to associate with his own powers, and to employ them for the service of such tasks as are fitting not to be brought about by God alone. The Father of the universe stands in need of nothing, so as to require the cooperation of others if he wishes to create. Yet, seeing what is fitting both to himself and to the things coming into being, he entrusted to his subordinate powers the shaping of certain things, though he did not grant even to these full and independent authority to bring their work to completion, so that nothing amiss might occur among the things that come into being. So much had to be sketched out first. Now I must say why. The nature of living things was first divided into two opposing portions, the irrational and the rational, and the rational was in turn divided into the perishable and the immortal kind, perishable being that of human beings, immortal that of the bodiless souls that circle through the air and heaven. These souls have no share in vice, for they received from the beginning an untainted and blessed portion, and were not bound to the body, that place of endless misfortunes. The souls of irrational animals likewise have no share in it, since, having no part in reasoning, they are not liable to the voluntary wrongs that arise from calculation. Almost alone of all beings, the human being, possessing knowledge of both good and evil, often chooses what is basest and flees what is worthy of pursuit, so that he above all stands condemned for sins committed with forethought. It was fitting, then, that God should attach the fashioning of this being to his subordinates as well, saying, "Let us make man," so that man's right actions might be referred to God alone, but his sins to others. For it did not seem fitting to God, the ruler of all, to fashion by himself the road to vice within a rational soul. For this reason, he entrusted the construction of this part of man to those who came after him. For the voluntary, as the counterpart to the involuntary, needed to be brought forth and fashioned as well, for the completion of the whole. Let this much be said on that point. But it is also fitting to reflect that God is the cause of good things alone, and of nothing evil whatsoever, since he himself was the eldest and most perfect good among all beings. It is most fitting that the best being should fashion, by himself, only what belongs to his own nature, the best things, while the punishments inflicted on the wicked are secured through his subordinates. My argument is confirmed by the words spoken by the one made perfect through discipline. The God who has nourished me from my youth, the angel who has delivered me from all evils, Gen 48:15-16. For he too confesses, in effect, that the choicest of good things, which nourish luminous souls, are referred to God alone as their cause, while the portion of evils is again entrusted to angels, though not even they hold full authority to punish, so that his saving nature might never be the author of anything that tends toward destruction. That is why he says, "Come, let us go down and confound." For it is the impious who deserve to meet with such a sentence, so that his gracious, beneficent, and generous powers may be made familiar instead with punishments. Yet knowing that these powers are beneficial to the human race, he ordained that they act through others, for it was necessary both that the wicked be judged worthy of correction, and that the fountains of his unfailing graces be kept unmixed with things that are not only evil, but even reputed to be evil. We must inquire what confusion is. How then shall we inquire? In this way, as it seems to me, often we come to recognize people we did not know before by way of their kinsfolk who bear some resemblance to them. In the same way, then, things that are not easily grasped from themselves might become clear through their likeness to things akin to them. What things, then, are like confusion? Mixture, as the old account has it, and blending. But mixture is tested in dry substances, blending in liquid ones. Mixture of differing bodies, then, is not a mere juxtaposition in some arrangement, as if one were to make a heap by bringing together barley and wheat and vetch and various other kinds of seeds into the same place. Blending, however, is not juxtaposition, but an extension throughout the whole in which unlike parts interpenetrate one another, their qualities still capable of being separated out again by some technique, as is said to happen with wine and water. For when the two are brought together, they produce a blend, yet what has been blended can nonetheless be resolved again into the qualities out of which it was made. With an oiled sponge, the water is absorbed while the wine is left behind. Perhaps because, since the sponge itself arises from water, it naturally reabsorbs from the blend what is its own, the water, and leaves behind what is foreign to it, the wine. Confusion, however, is the destruction of the original qualities, when they are all extended together throughout every part to produce the generation of one single, different thing, as happens with the four-drug compound in medicine. Wax, tallow, pitch, and resin, I think, when brought together, produce this compound, and once it has been composed, it is no longer possible to separate out the powers from which it was composed. Rather, each of them has vanished, and the destruction of them all has given birth to one distinct new power. So when God threatens confusion upon impious reasonings, he commands the destruction not only of the particular form and power of each vice, but also of the compound formed from them together, so that neither the parts by themselves nor the union and concord of them all should retain any strength for the overthrow of the better portion. For this reason he says, "Let us go down there and confound their tongue so that none of them may hear the voice of his neighbor." Gen 11:7. Which is equivalent to saying, let us render each of the parts of vice mute, so that it neither utters its own voice nor, by resounding together with another, becomes the cause of harm. This is our reading. But those who follow only what is plain and ready to hand suppose that what is now being described is the origin of the Greek and barbarian dialects. I would not blame them. Perhaps they too are using a true account. But I would urge them not to stop there, but to move on to the figurative interpretations, holding that the literal sense of the oracles is, as it were, the shadow of bodies, while the meanings signified beneath it are the things that truly subsist in reality. The lawgiver himself, indeed, gives grounds for this to those whose understanding is not blind, as, for instance, in the very passage now under discussion. For he named what came about confusion. Yet if he meant only the origin of dialects, he would have applied a more accurate name in place of confusion, separation. For things that are cut apart are not confounded, but on the contrary separated, and the two names are opposites, not only in word but in the very deed each denotes. For confusion, as I have said, is the destruction of simple powers to produce the generation of one thing compounded together, whereas separation is the division of one thing into several, as happens with a genus and the species contained under it. So if the wise lawgiver had meant to command that a single language be divided into the sections of several dialects, he would have used more exact and proper terms: division, distribution, separation, or something of that kind, not a word that fights against these, confusion. No, the aim is to dissolve the massed ranks of vice, to nullify its compacts, to abolish its fellowship, to destroy and annihilate its powers, and to tear down the strength of its dominion, which it has fortified with dreadful transgressions. Do you not see that the fashioner of the soul's parts brought none of them into fellowship with any other? Eyes cannot hear, ears cannot see, the juices within the mouth cannot smell, nor can the nostrils taste. Reason, in turn, cannot be affected by anything belonging to the senses, nor, conversely, can sensation give voice to speech. For the craftsman knew that it was advantageous for none of these to hear the voice of its neighbor. Rather, the parts of the soul were to exercise their own proper powers, unconfused, for the benefit of living creatures, being kept apart from fellowship with one another, while the parts of vice were to be brought to utter confusion and destruction, so that, whether sounding together or existing by themselves, they might not become a source of harm to the better portion. For this reason, he also says, the Lord scattered them from there. Gen 11:8, which is equivalent to saying he dispersed them, drove them into exile, made them vanish. For to sow is the cause of good things, but to scatter abroad is the cause of evil. The one occurs for the sake of increase, growth, and the generation of other things, the other for destruction and ruin. The God who plants wishes to sow nobility and goodness throughout the universe, but to scatter and drive out from the commonwealth of the world that accursed impiety, so that virtue-hating characters may at last cease building the city of vice and the tower of godlessness. For once these have been scattered, those who long ago fled the tyranny of folly will find their way home through a single proclamation, which God himself has written and confirmed, as the oracles make plain, where it is declared. If your dispersion is from one end of heaven to the other, from there he will gather you. Deut. 30:4. So it is fitting that the concord of the virtues should be attuned by God, and the discord of the vices dissolved and destroyed by him. The name most proper to vice is confusion, of which every fool is clear proof, employing words, counsels, and deeds that are worthless and in disarray.